Coast to coast and worldwide on the internet. This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
The Philadelphia Experiment was a case where the United States apparently dematerialized an entire ship at the port of Norfolk, Virginia, transported it up to Penn's Landing area near Philadelphia, and then brought it back to Norfolk again in 1943. The total distance of that trip exceeded 400 miles. Again, there are many different sources that confirm the reality of this actually happening. But some others say no, it never did. In a moment, our guest will be Al Bielek. He was there. In the Philadelphia Navy shipyard in the year 1943, the USS Eldridge and her crew involved in a top-secret military project called the Philadelphia Experiment. The objective was radar invisibility. The result was a disaster, producing an unimaginable series of events, and only a few men survived this experiment, two of whom had jumped from the ship and landed mysteriously on the Army base at Montauk, and that's in Long Island. That was the year 1983, 40 years later. And this 40-year time and space sleep seemed to take just moments, and that's part of Al Bielek's intriguing life story. He's with us for the next couple hours. Al, how are you?
I'm fine.
It's been a while. You know, when we last talked almost 2 years ago, someone had told me that you might have been involved in a car accident or something after that.
Yes, I was. I moved to Florida, and then there was a car accident in which I did not appear to be injured at the time, drove the car home, and that night after dinner I had a strange tingling sensation on my right side. I did not know what it was. 5 days later I found out what it was. It was the beginnings of a stroke. It was one of the next 5 days later in the morning I rolled out of bed on the floor and couldn't get up.
Well, you do much better now, I hope.
Oh, much.
Excellent. Al, what is the latest now since the Philadelphia experiment of 40 years ago? Has anything changed in terms of the concept of this experiment or things that we might not have been aware about of a couple years ago?
Very little. The experiment, of course, took place. The original concept was from Dr. Nikola Tesla, honorary doctorate. And it was his idea. He sold it to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, 32nd President of the U.S. Roosevelt, through the Navy, supplied the money to fund the project. And he did the initial work, which was very successful on the first test, the first one being in the Brooklyn Navy Yard in 1940, using a small ship with a lot lower power than was required for the Eldridge. And, of course, there was also an interim test in which they were going to go to a battleship, and that was the point where Tesla bowed out. He says he wouldn't be responsible for killing sailors, but he said the power level was much too high with the concept of how to do it at that time. And so he bowed out, and Dr. John von Neumann took over, continued Tesla's approach, and increased the power somewhat. The first test on 15 July was quite successful with no side effects, and then, of course, came the fatal test on 12 August 1943 with severe side effects. And I might add One of the big problems involved with this story is the concept that this was the USS Eldridge that was involved. It was not the Eldridge. The name was adopted later. By what means and how, I don't know, because there was an Eldridge launched in 1943, August 27th or 8th, from the Newark Shipbuilding Yards.
Right.
And it went to sea. It never took part in the Philadelphia Experiment. It was never in the Philadelphia Yard. And there's a long and mysterious story there, because I ran down all the pictures I could find out of the archives, and they show two ships. There is a DE-173, which is well known, and there is a 173, which is an entirely different ship and structure, with a knife plow front end, different superstructure, a number of different appurtenances were different. And that may have been the ship that was used. But my latest information is that the real ship that was used was supplied by the German government to the United States, because it was originally intended to be a joint project between the United States government and the Germans. See, we were not at war with Germany in 1940 or 41. They turned that ship over to us in January, February of 1940.
I understand. Okay.
And we were on very good relations then. Of course, we got pulled into the war through the back door of Japan attacking Pearl Harbor. And then the liaison continued until sometime in mid-43, because I was part of that liaison with the German, not a naval officer, a German aviator, who came over to Long Island. You can tell some wild stories about the German submarines coming up for the weekend off of Montauk Point on Long Island to sun themselves, charge their batteries. They'd wave at the people on shore, and the people on shore would wave back. It was a crazy war.
Some of the Germans even went ashore, didn't they?
They did, yes.
Unbelievable. Now,
it's unbelievable is right.
In that time period, Al, you were someone else, right?
Yes. My original name was Edward Cameron.
Had a brother?
Father was Alexander Duncan Cameron, Sr.
Okay.
And he was in the Navy himself during the period prior to and overlapping World War One into the time of about 1930, when he was retired from the Navy because of a physical disability.
The ship that you were on as Ed Cameron was which one?
Which was a German ship.
Okay.
So we have photos of the interior of that ship. I have them in my collection. And the interior ready room picture is much larger than those who investigated later to the real Eldridge and found that the real Eldridge didn't have a ready room that large and could not possibly have been that one, because it didn't match.
Why did they, or how did they, try to ease in the Eldridge ship in this whole project?
I cannot answer that one fully. I don't know, except there was a great effort on the part of the Navy after this thing was over and they had so many disasters to cover the whole thing up, and they adopted the name of a ship which was known to have been built and existed, and they wanted to cover up the fact that the real ship that was used in the experiments was not an American ship.
Tell me.
They conveniently, someplace, adopted the name, the Eldridge, which was a provable American ship having been built in the Newark Shipbuilding Yards.
During the experiment, Al, the disastrous experiment, tell us what happened. Paint us a picture of what things were like.
Okay, well, we had a very successful test, and I said in July. Then they decided to change the requirements somewhat. They didn't require full optical invisibility. They only wanted radar invisibility, because the thinking at that time was, you see, we had no satellites then, and none of the other long-range navigational systems
right.
we have now. The statement was made that we do not want optical invisibility, we only want radar invisibility, because if we have a convoy at sea at night and we have optical invisibility, we may ram one of our own ships.
Sure.
So don't want complete invisibility, we just want the Germans to be fooled into not being able to see our ships with by means of the radar. They had good radar at that time. So that was one of the reasons why they changed somewhat the requirement and cut it back so that it was only a requirement for the radar invisibility. So in the 43 test of 12 August, that was a requirement as modified. It would only be radar invisibility. That made some change in the requirements as to how the whole system was set up. But nevertheless, 3 days before the 12 August test, virtually everybody in the crew, it was a volunteer crew, and of course I was there and Duncan was there, and we were the ones chosen because of the fact we both had PhDs in physics.
And were you all aware of what was happening?
We were aware that something was wrong.
Okay.
We all both had that gut feeling, as did some of the other sailors. And we used to bail out of the back gate of the Navy Yard to a diner that was down the road about half a mile from the back gate, and go in there at night sometimes and have coffee all night. It was open 24 hours in. And we would discuss this, and we all had this strange feeling that something was wrong, but we didn't know what. Neither Duncan nor I could put our fingers on anything wrong with any of the equipment. It was not the equipment. The equipment was working fine insofar as its design projection and its design parameters were concerned. What went wrong was the fact that due to the nature of the way the field was set up, and actually, to describe it briefly, Tesla's original concept was to have a closed field like an egg around the ship, which would seal it off against any outside possible interference.
Totally engulfing the thing.
Totally engulfing the ship.
All right.
And there would be no problem to still have the invisibility that way, but it would lock out any outside interference of any kind. Well, pressure of the war and all of that, get something done, get it going as quickly as possible. He relaxed that requirement to allow a toroidal field, like a donut with a hole in the middle, and the Eldridge or the ship that was used would be in that hole, and it would be surrounded by a field which was in the shape of a donut.
Okay.
That left an open hole in the middle, and that is what happened, because the Montauk project, taking place 40 years later, overlapping a period of time, but particularly it was running on 12 August 83, and that was because of help we had from alien groups and how to make the whole thing work properly to what we wanted in 83. They had their own agenda, which was agreed to by the government, and they set up the requirements through channels that the final test would take place on 12 August 43, because the 12 August 83 was exactly 40 years later, and there was a synchronicity system involved here, if I may call it a system, a synchronicity aspect involved, in that you were dealing with the time fields of Earth and the fact that there's a phase shift every 20 years, and if you had it on a 40-year point, it was the maximum point where the Earth's fields locked in with maximum intensity, and there's a lot of very strange physics involved.
And it was like a closing window, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was actually an open window, which caught the Eldridge. Had the test been one day later or one day earlier, this problem would never have developed.
Right, the window would have been closed.
That's right.
Okay.
And so what happened was, the aliens had this thing turned on. They were using this to create a rift in the time field 40 years wide to allow certain of their ships from their home base to come in. They weren't after us. They weren't attacking us. They were pursuing a war which was going on in the solar system, involving certain of their ships and certain other enemies who we knew nothing about at that time, and who knows if we know anything about them now. But nevertheless, they got the ships through by creating that rift in the time field so that they could get their ships through, and that rift could only be created by locking up the two experiments, Montauk and Philadelphia experiments.
All right, so the
causing the huge rift in the time field 40 years wide.
All right, so a couple things were going on then. Not,
yes.
not only was the experiment actually occurring for radar invisibility,
yes.
but in 1983, this alien intervention needed to take advantage of the experiment as well.
Right. Now, I might add, of course, that those aliens were not somebody from outside, far away in space. They were all there by the invitation of the United States government. They were working on various projects for the government. They were helping us with our projects. And it was just that their price was they wanted to be able to use the Montauk facility for their own projects periodically. And that was agreed to in advance by the government not knowing anything about what they were letting themselves in for.
All right, let's get back to that in a second, because that's important when you make that time leap. So the experiment occurs, there's a disaster. Now,
yes.
What's happening to the crew before you and Duncan apparently jump ship? What's happening to the crew that was on that ship?
Several things. One, the field strength as embodied by the revised equipment by Dr. John von Neumann was so high that Tesla was afraid of it himself. And he said there might be a problem with dead crew members. What happened was it completely discombobulated the crews on deck, not those below deck, but the ones who were on deck who were stationed there as observers, such that they became partly invisible himself. They also shifted. Now, no one on board that ship was supposed to become invisible, but the ones on the deck did become partially invisible because we were very close to the, and inside the fields were being generated in order to produce the invisibility effect. It affected them psychically. It affected them neurologically. It affected their total body field such that they started fading in and out of visibility. And then the ship was not locked exactly to that one location. It was not anchored by any anchor or anchor chain to the water below in the lower part of the harbor. It wasn't even in the harbor. It was downriver. The ship was supposedly stationary, but it was drifting.
What made you and Duncan jump off the ship?
What made us jump off the ship was, first of all, we were running the equipment. Everything turned on and started to work the way it was supposed to. But then we started to get some very strange electric fields inside the control room, which it shouldn't have been. We were getting high-voltage walkovers from equipment which did not and could not produce high voltage. And it was inside the control room. The electron tubes were banks and banks of 606G tubes, which those who are familiar with tubes will know what model and type that was.
Yeah.
It was quite prominent then. And those things were starting to get brighter and dimmer. The heaters weren't holding constant level. And then this strange high-voltage phenomena seemed to develop, and there was some kind of strange arc over. Looking back at it, I can say it was not an electrical phenomenon. It was an etheric phenomenon which manifested in an electrical manner to us at that time. So we saw this. We were told prior to this experiment, if anything ever goes wrong, and we could not get any radio communication, that was shut off at the time, we were said, frankly, we are on our own, and what we do is up to us.
Okay.
So we decided at that point, well, we better shut the equipment down because it's out of control. We can't control it. So we went for the control knobs and everything else, and they were frozen. We couldn't move a thing. So at that point, with this electrical phenomena, or what we took as an electrical phenomena, continuing to get worse, we simply didn't know what to do, and we finally got the bright idea as, well, there's nothing we can do in here. Let's go out on deck. And we did. We opened the bulkhead door and went out on deck. We saw sailors milling around in a very strange manner. Both of us got the idea, let's go to the railing of the ship, and we both got the idea simultaneously, and looking back on it, it was a little strange. We both had the same idea at the same time, jump overboard, because that was in essence a violation of orders, but of course we were told that we'd be on our own.
Could you see the what the shape of that donut, whatever it might have been, in that green fog or mist that we hear so much about?
We could see the fog, but we could not see any kind of a donut field. We couldn't see the shoreline. We couldn't see anything beyond approximately, well, say about 6 feet beyond the railing.
Could you see the water down below from
No.
the top of the ship? You couldn't even see that. Okay.
No, the fog was so thick. When we jumped overboard, we were doing it on faith that the water was there.
Yeah.
And, of course, we never hit the water because the water wasn't there.
So you both jump.
Right.
And where do you end up?
We end up going through some very strange tunnel-like fields. And we were in sight of each other at the time. We finally wind up with a landing on our feet on dry land inside of a military complex because we recognized the chain link fence as a military fence.
Okay.
We had no idea where we were. We had no idea what was going on.
You're wearing your 1943 uniform,
right,
I guess.
Yes.
Okay.
We were both officers in the Navy, so we both had our officers' uniforms. We land there, then suddenly, in a matter of seconds, there was a blinding searchlight beaming down on us. From what we found out later, was a helicopter. And so helicopters, we were told this later after we were taken below deck, I said below ground level. And we didn't know what the craft was that had this blinding searchlight on us. But when the MPs came to get us, we knew what MPs were.
Sure.
And they grabbed us and took us to a building. We went in and the elevator door opened. We went down several levels and finally the door opened down where we were, and we went out and we see military and civilian personnel running around in this underground facility, and an elderly gentleman in a gray business suit coming towards us that we didn't recognize at all. And finally he comes up to us and says, "Gentlemen, I've been expecting you. I'm Dr. John von Neumann."
From 40 years earlier.
Yeah.
Now he's 40
now
years
old.
We
look at him and says, "You're who?" I said, "I'm Dr. John von Neumann." I said, "You couldn't possibly be. We left him an hour or so ago. He's a much younger man." And I says, gentlemen, I am the same John von Neumann you knew in 1943. This is 1983, and you're in the underground facility of Montauk Point.
And he knew that two sailors jumped ship.
He knew that we were going to jump ship and wind up there because it's a very convoluted aspect. We gave him a full report of what happened, and eventually that report he wrote up was filed. Of course, eventually he told us we had to go back to the ship and we had to literally destroy the equipment any way we could, axes or whatever.
All right, hold that thought, Al. We'll be right back with you, but very quickly. At that point, you're still Ed Cameron, right?
That's correct.
All right, we'll be back with Al Bielek. Or Ed Cameron in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.
The After Dark Newsletter. Subscribe now by calling toll-free 1-888-727-5505. Networks presents Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Our very special guest tonight, Al Bielek, the Philadelphia Experiment. We're going to take phone calls next hour with Al Bielek. Now, in the last hour of the show, I've got open lines for you. Peter Davenport's going to pop in. Here's a reaction for us to the ABC special on UFOs as well. But in a moment, Al Bielek. CDs. Get ready to write down this number, this website. The After Dark CD, two CDs, 2.5 hours of great bumper music, music and ghost stories, unforgettable calls to the program. Go to afterdarkcd.com. www.afterdarkcd.com or call this toll-free number. Operators are there. 1-800-598-2331. 1-800-598-2331. More of Al Bielek's incredible story in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Al Bielek. Okay, Al, so now you and Duncan have jumped ship. You've somehow gone forward in time 40 years. You land at Montauk Island, and waiting for you is the scientist from 40 years prior to.
Right.
He knows you're on the way.
Yes, and he told us we were in 1983, and we didn't believe him. And he gave us a cook's tour, or at least part of it, to see electronic equipment, computers, and such items, which did not exist in 1943. And he says, well, I got some business to conclude. I have to go to my office. I'll come back and get you. Here, sit down in the lounge and watch TV for a while. So we did. We sat down and watched large-screen color TV. In 1943, there was nothing larger than a 10-inch black-and-white tube. So we were looking at this and watching the program, Matt. I was seeing freeway traffic jams and discussions about man on the moon and the Cold War and all this. And I said, after a while, we looked at each other and said, maybe the old man was right.
Yeah.
So maybe we are in 1983 because none of this exists in the time we were at. So we look him up before he called us back. We found where he was in his office and I said, well, maybe you're right. There's some very strange things here. He says, gentlemen, we got a problem. And I said, okay, what's that? He says, well, you jumped ship off the Eldridge. The Eldridge had disappeared into hyperspace because it interacted between its field generators and what we have here at Montauk. And it yanked the Eldridge out of its other harbor and out of its normal location in space-time, and it's floating around in hyperspace. And we have to get it back to where it came from. And there's only one way we can do that. We can't shut the equipment off on the Eldridge. You got to go back there and shut it off any way you can, or smash it, whatever.
Did you tell him, look, the dials are frozen, for crying out loud?
Oh, we told him everything. He says, well, we don't... He said to us, he says, you have to go back. He says, no, we don't know how we got here. Just how are you going to send us back there? And so that's very easy, gentlemen. Here at Montauk, we have complete control over space and time. We can send you anywhere as we want in space or in time. He says, we'll send you back there with radiation-proof suits, and we will. When you land, you will take off the suits, and you'll go find suitable appurtenances, axes, whatever, and start chopping up the equipment. He says, certain items you don't destroy, but the rest of it, you chop it up until the generators start to wind down. So when you hear the generators winding down, then you know it's going to be over shortly.
And they were going to be able to plop you right down on the ship.
And they did.
Okay.
So we did as instructed, and we smashed the equipment, and eventually we heard the main generators winding down. At that point, we said, well, I guess it's over. So at that point, we went back out on deck.
1943.
Well, we weren't quite in 43 yet. The transition was in process.
Okay, okay.
Well, we knew we were in 43 when the field effects and all of the fog cleared. Then we could see that we were back at the starting point. But before that happened, we saw sailors running around on the deck, some of them fading in and out of visibility.
Were some of them stuck almost in...
I was just about to get to that.
Okay.
There were two sailors stuck in the deck, frozen in the metal, our bodies intermingled with the steel.
Oh, my God.
Then there were two more upright. One of them was our younger brother, Jim, who had enlisted in the Navy in the beginning of after Pearl Harbor, in the beginning of the war. And he was partly in the bulkhead, the upright, and partly not in it. The fourth man was there, the only one who survived naturally. He had his hand stuck in the steel. They cut his hand off and gave him an artificial hand later, but he's the only one of that group that survived. Below deck, there wasn't any problem. It was all up on top side.
Now, why didn't it affect anything down on the bottom?
The steel of the ship shielded everybody from the magnetic field effects from the generators.
Okay.
See, in those days, the strips were still all steel. Sometime after World War II, they started converting to aluminum hulls.
Right.
Because they were lighter and they were speedier. But in any case, these other sailors were visibly fading in and out of visibility, running around, and we just couldn't figure out what was going on with them. Well, that was a long story. That was one of the problems. But as I say, after we were there and the crew, they couldn't raise anybody in the captain's head and the captain's mast and the captain's quarters at all, couldn't raise anybody on the ship radio-wise, so they finally sent aboard a boarding crew with two-way radio, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And the boarding crew reported these sailors buried in the steel deck. And they couldn't locate the captain, and finally they roared back and says, well, we need another boarding crew to bring the ship back from here back into the yard. So they sent a second boarding crew, and which had the facilities and the capability of running the ship and bringing it back into the yard, whereupon everybody was ordered off the ship, and the Navy made an inspection, and the Navy decided to have a four-day-long board of inquiry, in which they asked everybody questions, including myself. Now, I have to add, at the point where we reappeared in the harbor and weren't quite sure yet where we were really in the harbor, Duncan took one look at Brother Jim and buried in the deck, not the deck, I'm sorry, the bulkhead, as I did. He went heading for the railing and looked back at me like, well, wasn't I coming along? I didn't. I decided to stay there and try to console James until he died. And Duncan jumped overboard, and he found out later he wound up back in the... someplace in the 80s, as part of the Montauk Project. So he was not there to back up any of my testimony.
He went off on his own?
Yes, he went off on his own.
All right.
And of course, after everybody was taken off the ship, the Navy had their Board of Inquiry. I told my version of the story.
Did they believe you?
No.
No.
Absolutely did not. I told John von Neumann, and he did, because this again was John von Neumann, 43, and he did half believe me. And he says, we'll discuss this later. So the Navy, after all of this, decides, and of course, all of the major equipment went aboard. The ship was burned out and had been chopped, wrecked, and had burnouts, electrical. And the Navy decides, well, we need to do one more test. We'll replace the equipment. They already had spares built, ready to go on other ships. They said, we'll rip out the burned-out equipment, we'll rebuild it, we'll do another test. So they did another test in mid-late August.
Did you volunteer?
Sorry, mid-late October.
Did you volunteer for that one, too?
No.
Oh, okay. I don't blame you.
Mid-late October, down much further down in the outer harbor, at night, anchored the ship, so to speak. Actually, they didn't anchor it, but they took it down there with the crew off, ran the equipment by remote cables so they could turn everything on by manual sequence from another ship. And they did that. The ship went invisible. And then about 20 minutes later, it came back from wherever it was, and it was burning. It was on fire. At that point, the Navy decided to wash their hands of the whole project. Says, well, we got to re-equip the ship. They were so short of ships, and they were grabbing anything they could to send it out to sea. And so they re-equipped the ship with normal equipment, left what was left of the other equipment on board, and put a normal crew on board, and the ship went to sea. Now, that ship that did turn up later, after World War II was over, a lot of Navy ships were put into mothballs.
Right.
And the real Eldridge, the DE-173, wound up, I got this from a sailor who was on board the Eldridge, called me some years ago, and says, I want you to know I was on board the Eldridge. He says, we were out in the Pacific, came back via Honolulu, I hitched a ride from Pearl Harbor back to the San Diego operating base, and then I said the ship was going to be decommissioned. I took a ride, and it was perfectly legal to do that. The ship was moved to James River Yard in Florida to be decommissioned, which it was in 1947.
The real Eldridge.
The real Eldridge.
Okay.
In the meantime, the one which we call the Eldridge, which I did finally run down some of the history of it, but I can't prove it.
And that's the one you were on?
Yeah.
Okay.
That one was given to the Greeks, along with a sister ship, for training purposes in 1951. And photos turned up in 1985 of this group of ships given to by the United States government and the United States Navy to the Greeks for training purposes. And what some Greek photographer took a long series of pictures, and they wrote a story about the Eldridge. They called it the Eldridge. And it went into the Greek Playboy. The pictures were good. They showed the real ship, and it was not the Eldridge. There were differences, very monumental differences, between the German ship, because it was a German ship.
Did this go to Aristotle Onassis?
No.
No, okay.
No, it was actually recommissioned. They had to clean up the rust, make repairs to the ship, and they finally eventually had to tow it across the Atlantic back to the Navy yard in Washington, D.C. It was cleaned up, rebuilt. And a friend of mine who had access to the records, we'll put it that way, I will not give his name because he had a lot of trouble for doing this for me, he found out that the ship was cleaned up, recommissioned, and the Navy kept it at their Washington, D.C. Navy Yard as sort of a show ship. And it was all cleaned up and very pretty, and he looked at it. He told me about it. I did not have access to the websites. He had a high-level clearance, and we had the could do that and force his way into it and see the pictures of it. He says, I'd like to make copies of these pictures, but it's eyes-only stuff, and all I can do is look at it. He said, this is the ship that was used in the real Philadelphia experiment. And
Could you verify that when you looked at it?
I could not. I was not allowed to see the pictures. I didn't have the clearance.
Oh, they never showed it to you. Okay.
No, I never saw the pictures of it. But he did, and he said, yes, this is the ship that was used in the real Philadelphia experiment and in the real ship, which was not the Eldridge. And it was given that number, 173, as a cover-up.
All right, now let me ask you this. I'm interviewing right now Al Bielek, The guy who went back was Ed Cameron. At what point did you become Al Bielek?
Years later. I remained in the Navy to kaleidoscope a lot of work.
Because you're close. How old are you now, Al? You're about 80?
Well, according to my official record as Al Bielek, I'm 77.
Okay.
But actually, I'm over 100.
You're over 100 years old?
I was born as Ed Cameron in 1916.
All right, now you're gonna have to tell me what happened.
Yes.
How'd you become Al Bielek?
I joined the Navy after I finished my schooling. Like Duncan, we enlisted together in New York, became part of the Navy operations. We both had eventually, not at the time we signed on. We signed on as lieutenants. And we eventually worked our way up in rank to the rank of captain because of our education, training, and what they wanted us for. So Duncan disappeared. I remained in the Navy. Eventually, they sent me up to Los Alamos Laboratories because John von Neumann was there on the bomb project, and he requested through the Navy channels they would like to have me work with him because I was quite proficient in mathematics then, and he wanted somebody to back up the work he was doing.
And you're still at Cameron then, right?
I'm still at Cameron then.
All right.
So I was there 42 through 45. Then I was on some other projects, and eventually, I married in the meantime, by the way.
Okay.
I had five kids. And eventually, the Navy pulled me out of what I was on there at Los Alamos because I got into some violent arguments with Ed Teller over the bomb, and he wanted to produce the hydrogen bomb, and I says, your math is flawed. You can't predict the yield on this thing. Oh, he blew up when I said his math was flawed. Well, eventually, he got the credit for it, but he did not himself develop the hydrogen bomb. That was given to one of the younger physicists in there. There was a contest as to who would come up with the best proposal or the most acceptable proposal to build a hydrogen device. And this was admitted by Dr. Teller in a radio interview many, many years earlier than now, but long after this whole period was over, that he did not develop the bomb. He took credit for it.
He took credit for it,
originally his proposal.
Okay.
So he was given credit for it. But I got into arguments with him. I was eventually invited to leave the lab. I went into other projects with the Navy, and that's a little long story, but eventually I was sent by the Navy to the Pentagon.
Still as Ed Cameron.
As Ed Cameron.
All right.
And in 1953, there was a big argument and question about what to do with me. I knew too much about secret projects in the Navy, and they wanted to get rid of me, but they already realized that they couldn't do the normal number, which would be to go out and give me the firing squad number. See, I had been traveled to time too much, and they knew that eliminating me that way would cause major disturbances in the time field. So they finally came up with a plot. We'll use some of the equipment at Montauk in 1983, which they captured from the Germans, for age regression. It was an experimental system, but it was workable, in which they could physically age regress a person back. Normally, they didn't take him back earlier than 21, but they did try to do an experiment on me to see if they could take me back to being an embryo, not an embryo, but about a nine-month-old kid. Literally, physically shrink me down to a nine-month-old kid. And, of course, wipe my memories totally before this happened.
And this is in 53?
This was in 53 this was done to me.
All right.
And I was sent back to 1927 to the Bielek family to replace a real Al Bielek, who apparently had, according to the story, got sick and went to the hospital and died in the hospital. So I was offered as an adoption substitute. And, of course, I inherited the name Al Bielek.
What an incredible story. How did the memory come back to you then?
That was many, many, many years later. At that time, I had no memory of what was going on.
So as you were growing up,
you were Al Bielek.
You didn't know anything about the Philadelphia experiment?
No.
Nothing. Okay.
Nothing. And this went on. I had an intense interest in the Philadelphia experiment in the period of the 60s and the 70s and became connected with Ivan Sanderson when he was running his operation in New York, as well as book publishing and over in Long Island, in New Jersey, Hope, New Jersey. And I was a member of his staff at that time. I used to go visit regularly. I had a great interest in it, and he had some files on it, but he could never get the truth out of the Navy. Was there a Philadelphia experiment? Yes. That's all they would tell him. And they wouldn't give him any details, whatever.
They still won't?
No. they still deny that it ever happened.
Right.
Now they won't admit it at all that it ever happened. But I was a part of that, and what happened was, eventually, the movie, The Philadelphia Experiment, was produced.
I remember that.
And I saw it one night on a large screen wall projection TV, and I hadn't heard of it. I'd not seen it before. So this was in January, I believe, of 1984. The movie came out, if I remember correctly, in 83, and went around the circuit and all over, and it was pulled sometime after, let's say, no, it wasn't 84, so it was 86. It went to the British bought the rights to it, then they started producing videos of it, and the videos came to the U.S., and some of the TV stations got a hold of them and started showing them. And I saw it that one Saturday night. It hit me quite hard because I felt that I was involved.
You just didn't know how.
I didn't know how right at that point. 2 days, 3 days later, the memory started to come back. Now, other people at the time thought, are you sure that you were really part of it? Well, I felt for certain I was, but when I started lecturing on the subject, because I dug some information out, and I kept running into people who remembered me from the time of the experiment, who remembered me from Los Alamos Laboratories, the fact that I was Ed Cameron, that I was a physicist in Los Alamos, and one chemist who was there, he remembered very well when he was living at that time down in New Mexico in Las Cruces, and then we went out for dinner one night and talked about the whole business. And he says, I remember you very well. You were there at Los Alamos. But he said, you were in a different department than I was in. So we were all working on the bomb project. Well, from there on, I went through some other regression improvement techniques and brought back more and more memories, and then I ran into more and more people who remembered me. And, of course, I ran into Duncan and then Preston Nichols, and eventually more of the story came back, and eventually I found corroboration from other people.
Because there is a person now named Duncan Cameron out here
Yes.
somewhere, right?
Yes.
Who is your brother?
He is my half-brother.
Okay.
Legally, he is a half-brother with different mothers.
Does he recall this story?
Yes, he finally recalled it. He recalled it under hypnosis. Preston, he had a lot of problems from the Montauk Project, which he became part of, and I also became part of. But he had so many problems psychologically that he was put under hypnosis for regression. He was taken from his then-current age back to the period of the Montauk Project until he was about the age of 12. Everything was, say, gelled coherently. And then he was asked in a hypnosis to go back to an age earlier than 12, and he jumps back to a time when he was on the Eldridge, or that was called the Eldridge. He says it was part of this thing called the Philadelphia Experiment.
Oh,
there were people here I know now under a different name. Al Bielek was there.
He was there. Hold that story, Al. We'll come back to you. We'll take phone calls next hour. We'll be back with Al Bielek in just a moment with his incredible story about the Philadelphia Experiment.